Now, at the beginning, we should check in our own minds that our mind is in a very positive, strong motivation for engaging in the activity of discussing Dharma tonight. As the subject matter is developing bodhicitta, then from what we know from the past, what we've heard, we should try and remember the feeling in our heart of the pervasive nature of suffering experienced by beings caught up under the control of karma and disturbing emotions, including oneself. I think that as there is a cause for suffering, karma, and disturbing emotions, then that cause can be eliminated through wisdom, the accumulation of wisdom, and the accumulation of merit or positive energy. So think that I and all living beings belong to one universal family. And I have had the great fortune to meet the Mahayana teachings of Shakyamuni Buddha. And so I shall engage in listening to the Dharma tonight in order to be able to train my mind to its full potential of Buddhahood, so I'll be perfectly qualified to guide others out of suffering. Now, we introduced this topic last Wednesday night, and I explained that this term, bodhicitta, which means the mind of enlightenment, can be seen from two aspects. There's the conventional mind of enlightenment, which is the sense of born out of great compassion. It is the intention to achieve enlightenment in order to be able to guide others out of suffering. And ultimate bodhicitta, the ultimate mind of enlightenment, refers to the wisdom realizing the ultimate reality of emptiness of inherent existence. So it is the ignorance, not knowing that reality, which is the cause of all problems. So, bodhicitta itself refers to our entire mind. The entire mind is intent upon attaining Buddhahood, our personal Buddhahood, in order to help others. So it's not just an intellectual idea, like we'll get lots of different ideas, you know, I want to go somewhere and do such and such a thing, or go and see such and such a pretty thing. There are lots of ideas which lead us to different activities throughout the day. But bodhicitta comes when it's developed, it comes without effort, and there is no question that as soon as we wake up, in particular, as soon as we see another sentient being, instantly there is the attitude of a great feeling of warmth, towards that senior being and the thought, I will achieve enlightenment for that sentient being. So, bodhicitta does not exclude a single living being from you know, one's scope of achieving one's full goal. If we discriminate even against one person or one sentient being, then we won't have bodhicitta. It is totally a universal attitude. At the moment, we have the spontaneous thought when we wake up thinking, what can I do today to be happy? What can I do today to avoid problems for myself, my family, my society? It's very narrow, the attitude. Kindness towards others, of course, is a virtuous, positive attitude. But it's only limited to this life. Bodhicitta, so that is a spontaneous attitude in our mind which colours all of our actions. Bodhicitta goes far beyond this life. It is to lead all beings to at least a happy rebirth, to liberation, and to full enlightenment. So, in the teachings, there are two methods taught by Shakyamuni Buddha, which have been preserved and brought down to us by the lineage lamas. These are called the sevenfold cause and effect method and the method of equalizing and exchanging self with others. Actually, when I was I spent 2 years in Taiwan about 20 years ago, no, 30 years ago, and we established an FPMT center. New Old Lama Zopa Rinpoche established a new center at the request of some Taiwanese people. And during my time there, Rinpoche asked me to give talks on Buddhism. During my time there, Rinpoche visited and gave initiations and talks and so on. And we visited many temples, mostly around Taipei and the northern half of the island. And we were very well received, and we met the abbots. And most of the temples were re-established from monastic communities on the mainland, which had been, of course, come to an end. But the practitioners, monks and nuns, had escaped to Taiwan and re-established their monasteries. So it was, Rinpoche was, he was just very interested. We were talking to the abbots and discussing your different practices. And he always would ask, what methods do you have for generating bodhicitta? You know, as thoroughly established, that is Mahayana Buddhism being practiced there. But what actual methods do you have to train your mind in bodhicitta? And it was a little bit sad that, well, you know, some of the answers were, well, we have the bodhisattva vows. True, they had the lineage and transmission of bodhisattva vows. But Lama Zopa Rinpoche was interested in this, but what actual methods? And there was no answer. Even though at many of the temples they do study Lama Tsongkhapa's Lamrim Chenpo, as translated into Chinese. But the importance of these two methods, somehow it didn't come across. Rinpoche says it's very sad. Even though they study Lama Tsongkhapa, we're just talking about the three or four temples that we went to, not say every temple, just the ones that we visited, they didn't seem to grasp the importance of these two methods, the seven steps of cause and effect, and the second method, equalizing and exchanging self with others. So these are the only two methods that we have for actually generating bodhicitta. That, at least that we know of in the Tibetan tradition. So, we may have heard, I'm sure, that most of you have heard them before and thought about it, but to actually meditate on them, to really take them to heart, is quite rare and so special. And just for us to be here tonight discussing Lama Tsongkhapa's presentation of how to generate, the two methods of how to generate bodhicitta, is so fortunate. It is unimaginably rare. Just to hear the word bodhicitta is unimaginably rare, and it is an unimaginable blessing for the mind. So as I mentioned last time, I'm not talking to you from the aspect of a practitioner of bodhicitta. It is my aspiration, for sure, to generate bodhicitta. But it hasn't happened yet. But I certainly have been inspired. So the first is said to be the easier way, training in the sevenfold cause and effect. And the essence of this particular method is to train our mind so that all sentient beings appear to us in a pleasing manner, as a child's appearance to the parents is pleasing to the parents' minds. So, as the appearance of our own mother or the sound of her voice is spontaneously pleasing to our mind. So the aim here is to train ourselves so that every sentient being, humans, birds, insects, animals, appear as if as our own mother, as our own child appears to our mind. So the first step, the first of the seven steps, has the two levels, the training the mind in immeasurable equanimity, and then training the mind in realizing that every sentient being has been one's mother in past lives. You know, in the Buddha's teachings, there's the immeasurable equanimity, immeasurable love, immeasurable joy, and the immeasurable compassion. So, at this level, immeasurable equanimity is shared with the Hinayana path. So, we need to have equanimity. We need to have a balanced attitude. Before we can have real love and compassion for others, our mind has to be balanced and not discriminate people into the three categories. Those who help us, we discriminate them through attachment as friends. Those who harm us or potentially harm us, we discriminate them as bad, not nice, enemies with aversion. And those who have no apparent benefit or harm towards us, we ignore them. We're not particularly concerned whether they're happy or unhappy. We sort of don't include them into our thoughts. So when we discriminate people into those three categories, then it makes it very difficult, impossible, to generate bodhicitta. So the first part of the meditation is we sit down and we meditate and we imagine. We think of somebody towards whom we have attachment. And we look at our attachment, how that they help us in one way or another, and yet we cling to them. We feel anxious and unhappy if we're separated from them. And if we look really closely, we sometimes we create negative karma. We're told small lies, we might steal, we might even kill. We do negative karmas in order to keep the person close. And the person, then we think of those who we dislike, and the opposite. We create negative karma, pushing them away. We let our mind just be filled with resentment and dislike, even anger. And that in itself completely eliminates our peace of mind. Because resentment and grudge-bearing, I've likened them in the past to being like a mental cancer, you know, like a physical cancer, eats away at our body and causes ongoing pain and progressive decline of our physical health. So anger is like a mental cancer in that it eats away at our peace. We cannot be happy when we're really filled with resentment, dislike towards somebody. And we create negative karma, which rebounds upon us as further pain. Then, those we ignore, we just see them as strangers, well, we don't get involved. So, looking at the situation in a more realistic way, is that we have to eliminate our attachment. It's not that we should push away our friends, but we have to stop seeing them as very special, like my friend, so important to me, and not, you know, being totally involved in holding them close to me. So we can reflect that, well, I know in my own experience, and I see in the experience of my others, that sometimes our best friends can become our worst enemy. In Australia, domestic violence is a huge problem. More murders and physical harm and verbal harm are committed towards one's own relatives. Theoretically, where people are killing the person who they married, who they thought was the most wonderful person in the world. But things change. And we become their enemy, they become our enemy. So we have to talk to our mind. And listen, mind, just see the reality. Your attachment is harming you. It's harming your friendship. And that's true. Because with attachment, we sort of put walls around somebody and we try to mold them to live up to our projections of how we think they should be. And so they feel pressured. They sort of back off. And they say, leave me, give me space, let me live my life. They still might want to be our friends. But it's our attachment that is poisoning all the good qualities of the friendly relationship. So we can even say, well, attachment, this person is nice to you in this life, but in previous lives, they've stolen from you, they've killed you, they've done all sorts of harmful things to you. See the reality. At the moment, they're just like you. They're an out-of-control mind and an out-of-control human being. And they need space. And the sort of reasoning. And so we work on our attachment. Similarly, we work on our anger. Anger sees the other person totally negative. But there are lots of situations where our worst enemy has become our best friend in our life. I remember reading the paper in a court case in Australia where there were two men. One had beaten the other up. I don't know whether he meant to kill him, but he'd really beaten him up, hurt him very much. And so he was sent quite a long time later. The court case came up, and the harmful one was being judged for his actions. But in the meantime, since that fight, the two men had become great friends. And so during the court case, the victim gave a positive character reference for the attacker. He supported him. So, nice example of enemies can become friends. And we probably know similar situations ourselves. So, when we recognize that we do discriminate people, we work on our attachment, our anger, and our ignorance, not caring about others. Because also there are so many situations when strangers have become close friends or become enemies, and there is so much benefit in widening our circle of friends with an intelligent mind. So in this way, we need to meditate until we gain a balanced attitude and we don't discriminate others. If we find we habitually don't want to, there's a particular person, we don't want to even hear their name, we hate other people saying nice things about them, we even dislike their pet dog or their car, you know, this happens. We shall mind, you are a little child talking to our own mind. You're acting like an infant. Grow up. Think of nobody is totally bad. Think of their good qualities. And at least, you can't love them, at least have a balanced attitude. So, that's the beginning. So on that foundation, the second half of this first step is realizing that every sentient being has been one's mother in past lives. This is difficult to realize. It's difficult to see everybody as having been one's mother. But it's essential for the next steps to be developed. So, you see, if we've heard about bodhicitta, we've read in the Lum Room, this presentation of the benefits of generating bodhicitta. And so, if we want to develop bodhicitta in our mind, which we really think about it, then that wish will arise, then we have to want to develop great compassion. And we have to want to develop universal love. Because if we don't have universal love, we don't have great compassion, no way can we develop bodhicitta. So seeing others as our mother is the method by which Buddha taught his students. This is the method that can lead you to the point where every living being appears in a pleasing manner to your mind. Okay? So, the reason of why every being has been a mother is based upon Buddha's presentation that life has no beginning. That our mind, which we call my mind, is not new in this life. Our mind came from a past life, prior to that, a prior life, and going back, no beginning. And therefore, as this mind has experienced birth in so many different lives, this mind has been, with its new body in each life, has been looked after by a mother. The scriptural authority, which supports this, is from the sutras. In the notes, the Blessed One declared, "When looking into the distant past, it is difficult for me to see that place where you have not taken birth, lived, and died." When looking into the distant past, it is difficult for me to see that person who has not been your father, mother, brother, sister, spiritual master, teacher. So what in these two sentences Buddha is taught that we have been reborn everywhere. We've had every type of experience of rebirth in the various realms of the wheel of life. And every being, there is not one person who we have not met in past lives. Then Nagarjuna, he said, if we try to count our maternal lineage with pellets of soil the size of juniper berries, the entire earth would not suffice to show the number of mothers we've had. And even one sentient being, or each sentient being, has been our mother not once, but countless times. Okay, so that's the reasoning. And we have to reflect upon that again and again. We have to really meditate on it. You can imagine it's different, you know, when we go to the supermarket. I've been taken to the big new one on the next station down the line. Big new supermarket. So many people. So big. Now, what do? Mostly we ignore them. The category of strangers. Occasionally, hi, friends, wave hands, friends. Occasionally we might see somebody we dislike. But we go there, we do our shopping, or we go to the restaurant, we do whatever we went there for, and then we leave. The other people are a bit of a nuisance, you know. Too many, they get in our way, whatever. And we go back home. But imagine what it's like if you've done the meditation on this, and every person in the supermarket, you see as you would see your present mother. You know, if you saw your mother at the supermarket, you didn't know that she was there. Oh, well, you know, or your grandmother, or your, you know, a close relative. Oh, you'd hug and you know, smiles and be very happy. That's just one relative, but they're all equally worthy of that, seeing them in that way and responding in that way. Of course, we'd probably be locked up if we went around hugging everybody. Mummy! Ah. But psychologically, it can be so blissful going to the supermarket. Normally I think, oh, it's a drag, it's too exhausting. But we get, if we really have done this meditation, that would be the difference. So different. Personally, in our own mind, we'd have a big smile on our face. We would be so joyful. And that is valid. This is not pretend. It's valid reality. Buddha explained that we've had this relationship with each other. So then the second meditation, a lot of meditating is involved. Remembering or thinking about the love and the kindness of all sentient beings. So, we use our present mother. Most of us have a fairly good connection with our mother. I know some don't. But particularly when we were young, most of it we can't remember. How, when our mother was pregnant with us, how she took great care of her unborn baby. She ate the right food. She avoided any activities which might have harmed her unborn child. She was already planning our education and our future happiness. That was the primary thought in her mind, was the welfare of her unborn baby. And so we were born, and she looked after us with such care. As I mentioned last time, she nourished our body with the milk from her breast, and she nourished our mind with the love from her heart. We needed that physically and psychologically to mature. It was primarily our mother who provided that, but not only mother, father, grandmother, grandfather, and other relatives as well. If we think of the kindness of the mother, as I mentioned, now we don't normally think of what it was like when we were little babies, when we kept our mother awake all night, crying, demanding to be fed, demanding to be cleaned, etc. We exhausted our mother. We can't remember. She can remember. But we can't. But it's reality. So kind. I noticed, before the age of computers, a lot of people traveling in India and Nepal. And so our only communication was mail, snail mail, letters from home. And I remember observing that when the mail came, the vast majority of letters that the young people got were from their mothers. Dads didn't write too many letters, but mothers did. And carrying on, worrying about their child in India, that terrible country where it's so dangerous, and so many things can go wrong. Okay. Now, when we've done this meditation, now imagine going to the supermarket. Not only do all those people appear as your mother, but you're acutely aware of their kindness. They've looked after you in past lives. Not only as humans, but as animals. When you were a kitten, mother cat looked after you. And birds. Birds, if you try to steal the eggs or the chicks from the nest, the birds will give up their own life to lead the invader away. So now, even more, to all the people in the supermarket, the shoppers, and the people in the shops, and everybody, you see them in such a different light. And then all the birds that are flying around the sky, and the animal, even the mice and the rats which you see occasionally darting from cover to cover. Totally different reaction. The third meditation, having thought about the kindness, it comes almost automatically, is the wish to repay the kindness. Just as we would love to repay the kindness of our present mother, we love looking after our mother, giving her gifts, making sure that there's no problems, whatever she needs, then this attitude is the next step. It's an even stronger relationship. So you're at the supermarket, and not only have they been kind, but how wonderful if I could repay their kindness. So, if we see a little child lost, or somebody drops something, or carrying a too heavy bag, delight, can I carry it for you? I find it's your mummy, the little kid, or somebody drops something. You lost this. And you do that with great joy. So now, the trip to the supermarket is really something special. And it's a fantastic opportunity not only to train our mind in loving others, delighting in others, but you observe mothers and their children and looking after their children, and fathers looking after their children, and brothers and sisters looking after each other. And just as in this life, you know, the New Year celebration, families come together, and you just feel joy in the warmth of mutual affection. And so the people in the supermarket are your extended family, and there is so much joy in watching people. And I may have come home and told you, in 2005, in Australia, I went into the Australian bush, I built a cabin, and I did a 3-year meditation retreat. And so I built a cabin with the help of my friends, and food was not cooked food, but raw food. Once a month, food would come up on the hill. I didn't see anybody. And I would cook it myself. So for 3 years, I saw no human beings. Kangaroos, yes. Snakes, yes. Lizards. Birds and parrots. But no humans. So for 3 years, imagine. And so when it was over, and I went back, it was near the city of Adelaide in South Australia, and I was staying with some friends there in their house, and I would go to the local supermarket and I would just sit on a chair and look at all the people. And I felt so happy. And I really, you know, as I've just said, you know, families looking after the kids and the interaction between humans, it was so joyful for me. Just that nobody tried to lock me up. But you really can have a very different outlook through training your mind in this way. So the fourth step is called the heartwarming love. Now, actually, it's called love, but it's not actual love. The actual love is the thought of delight in another's happiness. But this fourth step, the heartwarming love, is what I mentioned at the beginning. It is when beings appear to us in a pleasing manner. As I've described. So, this heartwarming love can only arise in our mind when we do the previous steps. Think of having been mother, remembering the kindness, wishing to repay the kindness, and then the heartwarming love. So you see, it's a gradual development of the mind. It's a bit like sculpting a statue. You know, you get a big block of marble, and so to get a beautiful statue, you've got to chip away and you reveal this beautiful statue. So similarly, in training our mind of bodhicitta, the end result is bodhicitta. Right? I said, that's the whole mind. So we have to work on our mind to reveal the beauty of bodhicitta. So heartwarming love is this fourth step. Then, from there, you do the next two immeasurable thoughts, the immeasurable love and immeasurable compassion. So, there's no fixed way. Either compassion can come first, and then love, or immeasurable love, and then immeasurable compassion. So, immeasurable love is the thought to make others happy. Whereas, what we call heartwarming love is just this beautiful, pleasing appearance. And then, naturally, we feel so affectionate, then naturally we have love wishing them to be happy and delighting in their happiness. So immeasurable because it embraces all beings without exception. And then we see that as much as we want others to be happy, there's so much suffering. And we see that when we go to the supermarket. We see unhappy people. Very distressed, very anxious, very tense. Children maybe fighting and fighting with parents. And we see sickness. People with limping and physical problems, mental problems, we see. There is so much unhappiness in the world. And we know from what we've learnt about the Dharma that people are under the control of their disturbing emotions and karma, and it's incredibly sad that if they have no door opening to understanding the cause of suffering, they'll eventually die and then they'll just be reborn again and again. So these are our mothers and fathers. So immeasurable great compassion is so powerful. Beings must be released from suffering and the causes of suffering. And then the sixth step, so immeasurable love and compassion are the fifth step. The sixth step is the special thought, the selfless intention. Right? Already, we have trained our mind to unquestionably relate to others as my family. From past lives, my mother, my father, brother, sister, they're my family. So, in this life, if our house, if our family house is burning down, and mother and father were trapped, we wouldn't just stand aside and ask somebody else to go and rescue mum and dad. Naturally, spontaneously, we would enter the flames. It's my mother, my father. Unhesitatingly, we would go into the flames to rescue mum and dad from the fire. So, now, we do see all sentient beings as suffering even worse than in a burning house. They're suffering in the terrible fires of disturbing emotions, of karma, and rebirth in the lower realms. So the sixth step is the sense of personal responsibility to guide all sentient beings out of suffering. You can see that. And again, it's not just, it's not a game, it's not pretend. It is there. The mind is in the attitude of, it's my responsibility. Nothing will stop me from guiding all mother sentient beings, all of my fathers, out of suffering. But at the moment, I can't prevent my own suffering. I am caught up, as they are, in the wheel of life. So, I must achieve my potential of Buddhahood. I must recognize and eliminate the causes of suffering from my mind and accumulate the merit, the power to be able to guide mother sentient beings out of suffering. I must achieve Buddhahood. So, when that thought, is the intention to achieve Buddhahood is totally manifest in our mind 24 hours a day without effort. That is bodhicitta. That's the seventh step. That's six causes, one effect. So those six causes lead up to that effect. And one generates bodhicitta. Okay, so that's the first method. You can see the gradual development that can be done. We shouldn't think it can't be done. It can be done. In particular, having generated the sense of universal responsibility and the special thought, it's my responsibility to guide my past mothers and fathers out of suffering. At that stage, we think of emptiness. We should reflect upon emptiness. And realize that the I, the ordinary I that I think I am, doesn't exist inherently, solidly, as I've always thought I exist. That the I that I am is merely labeled upon a body and mind. At present, I am a suffering sentient being. I am a childlike, deluded, sentient being because the mind in this body is confused, is ignorant. But that ignorance, that confused suffering mind, does not inherently exist. It's not poor, limited me, which very often we've clung to the belief that I'm an inherently existing, incapable of doing things, even in this life. That's wrong. There are so many things that our mind is capable of doing with the right conditions. But the point is, by thinking about emptiness, we should write, this is my Buddha potential. This is my Buddha nature. I'm not an inherently existing, ordinary person. I am a potential Buddha because Buddha is just a label put upon a body and mind which has eliminated all disturbing emotions, all the obscurations to enlightenment, and has accumulated the vast accumulation of merit. Such a person is called Buddha, and there is no reason why this person cannot be called a Buddha, because this person can accumulate the causes for Buddhahood. Be definite. So bodhicitta, the first method. Am I going too fast? All right, second method. Training in equalizing and exchanging self with others. This is more difficult, but it's more powerful. When we talk about exchanging self with others, the self in this context refers to the thought that cherishes the self before others. I think last week I called it self-importance or self-cherishing. So self-importance sees my needs as more important than others. Others are secondary to number one. So, exchanging refers to reversing that attitude and having the attitude the welfare of others is more important than this one. Right? Equalizing is talked about. So equalizing and exchanging self with others. So equalizing is in the first step in the notes. Seeing others as equal to oneself. So we need to do this to equalize ourselves with others to correct that very imbalance of seeing ourselves as more important than others. (Clears throat) So we begin this first phase or first step of equalizing and exchanging self with others by meditating on the first three steps or first four steps of the seven steps of cause and effect. So the equanimity of seeing, of not discriminating friend, enemy and stranger, but seeing people equal. We meditate on that. Then we meditate on all beings having been mother, remembering the kindness of mother and wishing to repay the kindness of mother. Up to the point of the heartwarming love, so that beings appear in a pleasing manner. So that precedes this step of seeing others equal to oneself. Now, we have to have stronger equanimity. My teacher, Geshe Jampa Techo, he said that equanimity needs to be stronger, because even when we meditate on equanimity, friend, enemy and stranger, equalizing them, there's still a subtle warmth towards friends and a subtle coolness towards enemies, right? There's not anger, but there's, we're still cool to the ones who've hurt us. We're still warm to the nice ones. We've got to get rid of that. Okay? So, we think, no one, not myself, no sentient being, wants to have even the slightest suffering. So, myself and others are equal in this point of view. So, we now cultivate this special equanimity. There are 9 points to reflect upon to cultivate this very powerful equanimity. The first, all sentient beings have helped us immeasurably, not only as our mother, but also as our father and our teacher and our friend. And so, in this life, there are so many people who help us to get what we need. And so, all sentient beings have helped us immeasurably. Fast way, they are my dear friends. Then our mind might object. Our mind might say, yeah, but they've also stolen from me, they've killed me, they've done all sorts of horrible things to me. So the next point to meditate on is, yes, but their help has been so much greater than the harm they may have caused us. And it's true. We look at our acquaintances in life. Really, the majority of people have been helpful or are helpful. And there are very few who have been really bad and even really bad all the time. So, and even mum and dad were so kind, but there are times when mum and dad have been harmful to me. As we're adults, I don't know about Singapore society, but Australian society, a lot of people can't stand their mother and father. It's not funny. It's actually very sad. Very sad. The parents are shifted off to old people's homes. And one of the greatest sufferings in my society is loneliness. Loneliness experienced by the older people. It's so sad. Anyway, the help that others is given is so much greater than the harm. The third point is that, look, we're all going to die. And if we want, if there's this special harmful person, you want to get revenge, you want to hurt them, then think about a whole bunch of prisoners in jail. They're on death row, right? And they're all going to be put to death hanging or electric chair, whatever, they're all going to die soon in the jail. And how pointless it is if they fight amongst each other about who sits where in the dining room. Yeah? Or somebody sits in your seat in the dining room. You're both going to die. And that's what it is. Our wish for revenge to get back at somebody who's hurt us is so strong. And it does happen in jails. I know you've seen the documentaries filmed in jail. The violence is so, from prisoner to prisoner, is so heavy. And we're talking about prisoners at death row. So our instinct, our response of anger is deep. Our dislike of people who have harmed us or have is deep. And we might think, and so is attachment. And we might think, I could deal with attachment, I can deal with anger, but hey, when the object of attachment or anger is there, oh, where's it come from? It's there. The fourth point is the main point. All sentient beings, all of us, equally want happiness and don't want suffering. But in our pursuit of happiness and our avoidance of suffering, not knowing the real causes of happiness and suffering, we hurt each other. Inadvertently, deliberately, we harm each other. But fundamentally, they feel just like me. And at this meditation, it's good to put ourselves in the shoes of somebody else, and say, well, if I were them, how would I respond? How would I be? To really identify with others, even with animals. You see, as a spider catches a fly in the web, Imagine that fly. You think, that fly's been my mother, my father, and they're terrified. This dirty big spider's going to come on and eat it. And really feel, how does the fly feel? Put your mind in that fly's body and then release it. Then you have to find a bit of food to give to the spider, because the spider also has been your mother. I find that very powerful, to have empathy for the suffering of animals. Next point is sort of logical. We think, if there are 10 beggars who are equally hungry and they ask for food, it's just not right to give food to those you like, those who look cleaner, nicer, and to not give it to the ones who look smelly and dirty and horrible. You should give it to them equally. And similarly, if you have medicine and there are 10 sick people, it's not right to just give the medicine to a few who look nice, but not to those who look bad. We should give it equally to all. And we reflect upon our attachment, our aversion, and understand that good person and bad person comes from our mind. Attachment projects good onto somebody who pleases me and projects bad on somebody who harms me. And we see them as inherently good and inherently bad from their side. But actually, it could be completely different. The one who is benefiting me could be just bribing me, is going to cheat me. And the one who is apparently harming me actually wants to help me, but I interpret what they're doing as bad. So bad's not coming from their side, it's coming from my side. And good that's coming from my son. So meditating on emptiness. This is all part of the first step of equalizing and exchanging self with others. So that's the equalizing side of that particular method. Next step is reflecting upon the many faults of self-importance or self-cherishing. So the Kadampa Lamas say that you should put all the blame for all your problems onto one thing, self-cherishing or self-importance. The problem is in here, in my mind. It is my attitude, my arrogance, my self-importance. It's not the other person. It's not the other situations. So as Geshe Jampa Techot, when he taught this to me, he said, you know, if you want to tame a bull, a wild bull, I've never tried to tame a wild bull, but one method is to put a rope around its neck and put it to a stake and gradually subdue it. The other way is to grab it by the horns and you hold it down. That's really hard, but it's a quick way. So we have this expression, you grab the bull by the horns. The bull is self-cherishing. And so we've got to attack it. I remember one time, in part of this meditation is the Tonglen, the giving and taking, where you imagine yourself cherishing as a black rock in your heart, and you take on the problems of all sentient beings and you give it to yourself cherishing. Well, at that time when I was in Taipei 30 years ago, and Roger Lama Zopa Rinpoche's attendant was there, and Roger's got the hardest job of all. He has to arrange appointments for people to see Lama Zopa. And it's always difficult because Lama Zopa sees some people for hours. And so you've had an appointment, has put off until tomorrow or the next day. So there was one lady who, unfortunately, not Roger's fault, her appointment to see Lama Zopa Rinpoche had been put off a couple of times. And Huang Shiru, who was my translator at the time, she said to Roger, "Oh, she hates you to death." And Roger just smiled and he opened his shirt. Gave her hatred to his self-cherishing. So that was really good. There's a whole list of things here. We won't go into them, but you can read them. That, you know, self-cherishing is ultimately responsible for every unfavorable experience in life. And it is. Every sickness, every fear, every suffering of loss, every punishment comes from self-cherishing and creating non-virtue due to our inability to give up attachment to worldly concerns of food, clothing, reputation, and so on. It's like, I think many have read the Arya Sangata Sutra, you know, strongly recommended by Lama Zopa Rinpoche. Now, the Arya Sangata Sutra, there's a story of this man who planted a mango tree. Was it a mango tree? And in the same day, it rooted, it grew leaves and flowers and fruit, all in one day. And another man came along and tried to do the same, and his tree did nothing. So they were squabbling and fighting amongst each other. And the king heard this and he said, "What's the problem?" And they explained, and the king didn't believe it. He locked them up in the jail. And then he said to this man, "Is it true that a seedling grew like that and had fruit all in one day?" And I said, "Yes, plant one for yourself." So the king went out to the field and planted a tree, and it didn't grow, it just died. So he got very angry and he cut down the other man's tree and it multiplied and multiplied again, and all these miraculous things happened. So he said, bring those men to me. So they were taken from the jail and brought to the king. And the king said, why didn't my tree grow like yours did? And the man said, because you don't, king, you don't have the merit that I have. And all the ministers realized that, and anyway, they asked him to be the king. He said, I don't want to be king. He said, I came here, I was thrown into the king's prison, and that was to purify karma created through self-cherishing, through self-importance in past lives. I'm so delighted that that karma has now been eliminated. I want, and I don't want to waste my time with kingly activities, I want to follow the path to full enlightenment. Anyway, so the point is, he was unjustly thrown into jail, but that couldn't have happened if it wasn't for self-cherishing in the past. So even we're unjustly accused of something, criticized, whatever, it cannot happen if we haven't created the negative karma through self-cherishing in the past for it to happen. The fault is not the lying person who's accusing me of doing something I didn't do. The root fault is in here, self-cherishing. Yeah? No anger towards that lying person, as this man had no anger towards the king. Just gratitude for enabling me to be free of this negative karma. So this is how we, every day, you know, the situations, there are so many opportunities to train in bodhicitta and destroying self-cherishing is taking the bull by the horns. So there's a whole list of things about self-cherishing. You can read them. The next step is contemplating the advantages of selflessly cherishing others. So of course we have to have the heartwarming love for this. We have to have done the seven steps of cause and effect, at least up to the point of heartwarming love, so that others do appear to us in a pleasing manner. Then we reflect upon the advantages of selflessly cherishing them. For others, having this attitude of great cherishing others, it gives them peace, it gives them happiness, and it gives them relief from their troubles. For ourselves, it creates a cause for a higher rebirth. It creates a cause to have a beautiful environment, an attractive body, wealth, health, and a perfect human rebirth, you know, meeting the Dharma. Why don't we do it? Selflessly cherish others. We can achieve, it creates a cause to achieve bodhicitta, liberation, and enlightenment. All sentient beings, every sentient being has the seed of compassion in their mind. The compassion, wishing to help others. There is no, not even the most evil person doesn't have this, at least the seed of compassion, wanting to help others. So, it's imperative. We have the seed of compassion, but we must nurture it. It's not no use having a seed of a mango tree. I like mangoes. That wasn't a hint. No point in having a mango seed if you don't plant it in the ground and grow mangoes, right? No point in having the seed of compassion and not moistening it, nurturing it. And life is the opportunity to do that. This human life. When great compassion is achieved, self-cherishing stops. Right? We've just been through this whole, well, we haven't, but you've got it in the notes, the whole list of problems of self-cherishing. What is the antidote? Universal compassion. Great compassion for all beings. Before bodhicitta. Right? It's an obstacle to achieving bodhicitta because great compassion is the immediate cause of bodhicitta. So you see, we know that we have some empathy, some compassion. So many opportunities to add fertilizer and water and nourishment to that seed of compassion in our heart. The fourth step is to the actual thinking that exchanges thoughts of self for thoughts of others. So, initially, others are limitless, and we're just one. There's no reason. How can my happiness be more important than the happiness of countless others? So we have to make five definite decisions. The first is to abandon self-sensitivity, self-consciousness, self-importance, and replace them with the self-confidence, I shall lead all beings to happiness and freedom from suffering. My responsibility. I will do it. Don't back off. It's an English expression. Don't sell yourself short. that expression means, don't ask for a price lower than what you're actually worth. You are a baby bodhisattva. Grow up. Third definite thought, self-cherishing is the real enemy. Third, cherishing others is the best way of behaving, the best attitude in life. Fourthly, I must practice exchanging self and others. And finally, I must do so single-pointedly, unwaveringly, day in, day out, 24 hours a day. This is my raison d'être, my purpose in life, is to exchange, seeing myself as more important than others and putting them down. I have to see others more important than myself and put myself second. So based upon that, the fifth step is meditating on giving and taking. So this in Tibetan is called Tonglen, giving and taking. And it is next week or next time. Not next week, but the week after, we can talk about Tonglen because it's so important, where you visualize suffering sentient beings in the different realms, hells, hungry ghosts, animals, humans, divine beings. And you imagine their sufferings, you really have empathy for their sufferings. You imagine yourself yourself cherishing. It's like a rock, a black rock at your heart. And you imagine that you breathe in, you take upon yourself the pain and anguish of others. There comes like a black cloud that turns into a lightning bolt that strikes self-cherishing and destroys it. And as you breathe out blissful, blissful white light, giving your body, your wealth, and your virtues to the three times to others with immeasurable love. So immeasurable compassion, immeasurable love. And then you conclude with the final two steps of the seven steps, cause and effect, generating the special attitude and bodhicitta. So, I've just put a note here that when we talk about meditating on bodhicitta, then it can be meditating on these two methods, the seven steps of cause and effect, and or meditating on equalizing, exchanging self with others. The next page, Lama Tsongkhapa, has put them into the 11 steps. So that's combining the two methods into one, the 11 steps. In Australia, our teacher just explained that when you're actually meditating on bodhicitta itself, not developing bodhicitta, but having generated bodhicitta, your mind is meditating on enlightenment, your enlightenment. This is the essence, the intention to achieve your enlightenment. That is the essential aspiration, bodhicitta. The aspiration to release all sentient beings from suffering is called the causal aspiration to achieve bodhicitta. It is an aspect of bodhicitta. But meditating on bodhicitta is the intention to achieve Buddhahood. We need to remember that. I can become a Buddha. I must become a Buddha. I will become a Buddha. And that's so powerful. At the moment, we wake up, I can be happy today. Must be happy today, I will be happy today. You know, that's what we normally meditate on. Or, you know, even happiness for my family and friends too, but that's not enough. All right, so very briefly tonight, we've gone through the two methods for generating bodhicitta. And as I mentioned at the beginning, these are the only two methods the Buddha taught, well, that we know of, that have come down to us through the kindness of the whole lineage lamas going right back to Shakyamuni Buddha. They're so precious, and we should try to spend some time each day just bringing to mind just the outline of the meditation and the purpose. And in particular, I think trying to reach the point where every sentient being appears to our mind in a pleasing manner. Mosquitoes, rats, mice, cockroaches. Pleasing, not disgusting. Okay, any questions? We've got a few minutes for questions. Okay, well, thank you for coming tonight. Thank you for your attentiveness. It is the most important subject that any of us could ever think about, hear about, talk about. So, I hope you are able to put more energy into training your mind in bodhicitta, especially at New Year when you are surrounded by family and friends. Think of this and don't be attached, and just radiate the warmth. And There is no better way. You don't have to buy special presents. That is the best present that you could give for everybody at New Year's Eve. So let's dedicate not only the positive energy of this meditation, but the whole year. That, well, not only from the New Year onwards, but from tonight onwards, may all this energy ripen so that we achieve Buddhahood, our full potential, and become perfectly qualified to guide all Mother Sentient Beings out of suffering. I will be the one who answers their call when they cry out for help. Thank you very much.